This is Community Perspective, a public affairs program presented by Salem Media of Georgia and our stations WFSH, WGKA, WNIV, and WLTA. Each program, we highlight issues of importance and interest that affect our community.
Welcome to Community Perspectives. My name is Mike Blakemore from 104.7 to Fish, WGKA, and WNIV. Today, our guest is David Rubel, author of If I Had a Hammer, Building Homes in Hope with Habitat for Humanity. And of course, that's kind of a big thing for us here in Georgia because Jimmy Carter, also part of Habitat with Humanity, and he's from here, obviously, and a big part of that whole organization. And David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Mike. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, you're very, very welcome. Very interested in this book, and I got a chance to look through it. Tell us a little bit about this book, and you've obviously written many other books before. What made you decide to write about Habitat for Humanity?
Well, actually, it was serendipity. I got a call from Habitat. Habitat was really interested in reaching out to young adults. As I'm sure you know, you have to be 16 or 18, depending on where you are in the country, to work on a Habitat job site because a job site's a little dangerous. So Habitat wanted to find some way that the organization could reach out to people like my daughter, who's about to turn 12. And so they came to me because I had a lot of experience writing for that age group, and we talked about what sort of book might work out, and we came up with If I Had a Hammer, which is basically the story of not only how Habitat got started, but also what it's doing now, and most importantly, the effect that it has on people's lives, how it really transforms the lives of so many people, from homeowners to volunteers to even people who work for Habitat.
Now, before you wrote this book, have you had any experience with other books similar to this, with volunteerism, or is this the first time that you've been able to touch on this subject?
No, the closest experience I had is that I've written a number of books on the U.S. president. So I'd written about President Carter before, mm-hmm. but I hadn't written about volunteerism. And for me, it was a very special book to write because, well, my wife likes to say that I explain things for a living. And so a lot of the books that I do involve me gaining expertise in a subject, and then I'll think about it and break it down and put it back together in a way that I think other people will be able to understand it. And what made this book different was that I got to be a conduit, not just for the information, but for the feeling that a lot of these people had. And it was great to be able to write their emotions. It was great to have them share their emotions with me, and then for me to be able to take their stories and tell them in a way that other people could be moved by. And really, the best thing about this book for me was that after I had interviewed someone and written up the portion of the book that describe what they'd done, I would usually send them the text just to make sure that I'd gotten the nuances of the story right.
Right.
And more than one of them emailed me back and said, it made me cry. And
really?
For a writer to have someone say that my telling of their own story made them cry, it was a really special feeling.
Well, it's definitely a gift to have, to be able to tell other people's stories for them. I mean, like, for instance, one of my gifts is to interview people and find out about their story. So I'm kind of doing what you're doing, but just the radio form of it and learning about it. How did you get President Carter involved with all this?
Habitat brought President Carter along. That was actually a really wonderful thing for me with this project, to be able to spend time with the president and Mrs. Carter, especially since I'd written a couple of books on the presidents.
Right.
To be able to sit down with the man just across from me. And one of the very nice things was, in an interview like that, he's paying attention to me, and he's answering my questions.
Yeah, you have the president of the United States' undivided attention, which is not a too common thing to have.
Absolutely, and he also is he's such a gracious man, and put me completely at ease. Usually, as you know, it's the subject of the interview who can be a little ill at ease.
Right.
In my case, I was slightly ill at ease being in his presence, but the interview went really well, and President Carter has talked a lot about Habitat over the years, and I was able to go through the Habitat archives and read a lot of what he'd said. But what was great about the interview was I was able to get some things out of him that he'd never talked about before, at least as far as I know, including his first experience with Millard Fuller, who was the founder of Habitat.
Right. Yeah, I read about that with Millard Fuller and his story, because there's a guy who had all kinds of money, had everything, and then changed his world around and decided he almost lost his marriage.
Well, his story and the story of the founding of Habitat is really fascinating. When I first started doing the book, I knew what most people knew about Habitat. The organization built houses, and President Carter helped. And it seemed very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But in researching the organization, I found out that the history of it is fascinating. Millard Fuller was a fellow who went to University of Alabama Law School with Morris Dees, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them didn't really like practicing law that much, especially Millard. He had a mind for business. And so he started a mail order business back, in fact, when he was still in law school, and made a million by the time he was 30, selling cookbooks, oven mitts, all kinds of things in the early 60s. And he was so obsessed with his business that his wife, Linda, became alienated from him and distraught. And finally, she said, I'm leaving you. You're too obsessed with your business. And that snapped him out of it. And he realized that she mattered more to him than his business. And she went from Montgomery, where they were living, up to New York, where she had a friend. And he followed her up there and he said, listen, what can I do to get you back? And so they talked about that, and they decided the only way for him to really give up his obsession with money was for him to give it all away. And so the Fullers sold off all their property and gave it all away. And they went.
It's amazing.
They went on a celebratory trip to Florida. And this is before Disney
World. When you said that, I thought, well, how did they pay for the trip? They gave away all their money.
They kept some.
Yeah, I know.
And as all historians know, Mike, you know, not every detail gets nailed down in a story. And on their way back, they were driving through southern Georgia, and they went to visit a friend of theirs who was staying at what they call an intentional Christian community, more of an experimental Christian community, in my view, Koinonia Farm, which mm-hmm. is just outside Americus. And that was founded by a fellow named Clarence Jordan, who believed that churches were getting in the way of Jesus's message. And he thought that the most important thing was for everyone to return to the lifestyle of the first century Christians. So he founded this community in which it was essentially a communist society. Everyone shared everything and loved one another. And so the Fuller stopped there to visit a friend who was staying there. And they were just going to stay for lunch and continue on their way back to Montgomery. And instead, they stayed for a month. And Millard found a completely new way of looking at the world from listening to Clarence Jordan. And the two of them founded something called the Partnership Ministries. And they did something called partnership farming, which was allowing neighbors of Koinonia Farm to use the farmland free of rent, low-income neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
They did partnership industries, where they hired unemployed people to work in the farm's pecan shelling plant and fruitcake bakery and mail-order warehouse. And they did partnership housing. And this is where it may start to sound familiar. Partnership housing was a venture in which they used donated funds to buy construction materials to build houses for people who were living in shacks that had no plumbing, and used volunteer labor. Because, as everyone knows, when you build a house, there are two expenses, materials and labor, right. And really it's labor.
Labor's the big cost.
Labor's the big cost. So if you have the volunteer labor, you can build a whole lot of simple, decent houses mm-hmm. for very little. And so Millard started to do this, and in the first 5 years, he'd built 27 houses, which was many, many more than he'd ever imagined.
Sure.
And he started to scratch his head and said, you know, there's something going on here. And he also realized that it was self-supporting, because what they did was the family that moved into the house would pay back the materials cost over time with a no-profit mortgage. So money was kind of starting to come in from all these families living in these 27 houses. So that money was used to build new houses for new families.
This is a domino effect.
Exactly.
Financial domino effect.
And that was the beginning of Habitat for Humanity. And when President Carter got involved, it just took it to an entirely new level. And the way he got involved, which was the original question was that Millard Fuller wrote him a letter in 1980, his final year in the presidency, asking him to appear at some Habitat event because he was a local boy.
Sure.
And I read
the president was actually, it was towards the end of his presidency, and he was reading through his local newspaper just to kind of
get
in touch with home before he went back
home. That's exactly right. Well, what happened was Millard sent him this letter, and he never saw it because, as he told me, you know, when I was president, I got 40,000 pieces of mail a day. I didn't see every letter that got sent. But Millard felt that his letter should have been responded to. And when he didn't get a response, he wrote a letter to the America's Times Register saying, who does this guy think he is, this president? And that's the letter that President Carter did see. And he told me, he said, I thought this guy was a nut. And so he moved back to Plains and didn't want to have anything to do with Habitat. But there were enough members of his church who were active in Habitat who said, no, Habitat's a really good thing. You got to get involved. It's really changed our lives. It'll be important. And so it took President Carter a little while to get over, I think, his peak at that letter that Millard Fuller had written. But he eventually invited Millard and Linda Fuller over to his house, and he and Mrs. Carter sat down with them and said, what can we do to help? And Millard got back to him with a list of 15 items that were all kinds of things, from fundraising to pray for us. And President Carter said at first, okay, I'll do two of these things. You pick which two. And as he likes to say now, eventually he's done all 15 and many more.
Wow. And President Carter, from what I understand, and his wife, they donated, what, a week every year that they go on trips and help out?
Well, there's a week that everybody knows about, but there's much more time, of course. What happened was, the first thing President Carter did was get on the board and help with fundraising. And then, and this is actually one of the more amusing stories in the book, I think. There was this fellow up in New York City, where I grew up, who was a recent college graduate, a member of the Metro Baptist Church up there. And the Metro Baptist Church had a ministry in a very bad neighborhood on the Lower East Side called Alphabet City.
Right.
And
why was it called Alphabet City?
Because if you go east of First Avenue, you get to Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C, and Avenue D. So because they were named after the alphabet, it was called Alphabet City.
Gotcha.
And back in those days, it was very bad drug problems there. And this church had an outreach ministry, and they realized that one of the biggest problems in the neighborhood was really poor housing. So they started a Habitat affiliate, one of the first affiliates, a very early one. And at the time President Carter joined, there were only about 50 Habitat affiliates in the world. Hmm. There are now just 1,500 in the United States and another 800 overseas.
Wow, that's
And it was
incredible.
Really President Carter who made that difference. So President Carter was coming up to New York. This fellow, his name is Rob DeRocker, saw that President Carter was coming. He's now in marketing, and this is how he thinks, like, okay, if I can get President Carter to come to my project, maybe I can get some interest going and some more volunteering.
Sure.
So he wrote to Millard Fuller saying, hey, I see that President Carter's coming. Could you use your influence? And he never really thought it would happen, but President Carter came to his job site, and he took a tour, and this was a building where the stairway had been ripped out because the stairway had had these marble treads on it, which had resale value. So junkies had long ago
laundered the place, right?
Yeah, there was nothing left. So volunteers had built a wooden staircase up to the roof of this six-story building. And it was a little rickety since it had been built in a day or so. And when the president got there, the Secret Service said, you're not going on that staircase. But he went up anyway. And Rob tells this lovely story about when they got to the roof of the building, the president looked north to Midtown Manhattan and saw all the big office buildings there, and looked south to Wall Street, another visible sign of wealth.
Right.
And then he looked down, and down in the vacant lot next to this building was a woman cooking some food over an open fire, as though it were the middle of the third world.
Wow.
And the president stopped and was taken aback by seeing this. And when they went down, back down the rickety staircase, President Carter said to Rob, he said, you let me know if there's anything I can do to help you here. And so Rob said, well, you know, maybe you could send up some people from your church to help us work on the place. I know there are a lot of good carpenters down in Georgia.
Sure.
And President Carter said, well, I'll think about it. Well, he did a lot more than think about it. He went back to Plains and he talked to Millard and he said, listen, I want to bring some people up to work on that building. And President Carter, in his humility, says, I was a little worried that I couldn't fill the 8-seat Habitat van. Well, of course, he ended up chartering a Trailways bus and bringing 42 people up.
Wow.
Who spent a whole week alongside him and Mrs. Carter on their hands and knees working on this really a building in truly terrible shape. And people were amazed. It got an enormous amount of media attention because a president had never done that before. You know, could you imagine Dwight Eisenhower doing that? It just wasn't how people thought of the presidency. And the publicity from that put Habitat on the map. And every year since then, the president and Mrs. Carter have done a one-week work project, both either in the United States or overseas. They've been in South Africa. They've been in Hungary. They've been in the Philippines. They've been literally all over the world. And during that week, they'll put up 100, 200, 300 houses for people with, at times, I think at one project they had 15,000 volunteers from all over the world putting up 300 houses. And it's a remarkable thing. And then, of course, he does so much else for Habitat as well as for so many other causes.
Absolutely. I was interested to find out that I think when you have that many volunteers at one time working on houses, you can really make it happen quick. And I noted one spot in your book where you said that they set a record putting together a house in just a few hours.
That's true.
I mean, because you know what? If I put a house together that quick, you would look at it and it would all fall down in 1 second. But these guys are really doing a good job.
Well, a lot of these people are professional builders. The way Habitat works, and this is the part I found really interesting, most volunteers know nothing about building houses.
I know I volunteered one time up in Tennessee when I worked there, and you're right. I didn't know what I was doing, but if you can hammer a nail, you can help out with Habitat for Humanity.
That's right. And the reason that works is that they have what are called house leaders. And the house leaders are, for the most part, professional builders who really know what they're doing. And they've broken down the tasks in a way that it's easy for anybody to help. And when for these blitz builds, which is what the Habitat term for building a home really fast, often they get competitive with each other. You know, so the guys in Alabama will say, I can build it faster than those guys in Ohio. And so they compete and they figure out what can we do to have it go up as quickly as possible. And now it's down to like an afternoon and they can put up a house. It's a really amazing thing to watch.
That is unbelievable how they can do it that quickly. And it just shows the power of people together all for one cause and helping out together. And I think a lot of people also discovered the good feeling. You keep talking about that in your book, about the good feeling that you get out of this and that how actually people need each other. The rich people need the poor people as an opportunity to give, and the poor people need, you know, those that have something. They need that help as well.
Yeah, Mike, that's exactly right. One of the things that President Carter taught me is that the most important thing in society is being understanding the importance of the gap that exists between the haves and the have-nots. He thinks that's the core social problem, and I agree with him. I think that so many other things come from that. And his feeling is that it's too much to expect the rich to be able to cross the chasm individually. One person can't do it. And what makes Habitat such a special organization is that it provides a bridge so that people who have means can interact and help people who don't have means in a way that's respectful and dignified and comfortable for both of them. And that all goes back, actually, to the theology, really, of Clarence Jordan at Koinonia Farm. And what Millard Fuller took from Clarence Jordan and put really at the bedrock of Habitat is the idea that the rich and poor need each other. The poor need resources to live, and clearly they can get those from the rich. Money, but not just money, jobs, economic activity. And people forget that the rich need something too. In fact, often the rich forget that.
Right.
And what they need, according to Clarence Jordan, is a strong connection both to God and to other people. And that he believed those connections couldn't come without giving, without caring, without loving. And so what makes Habitat so special and really so different from so many other charities is that it's not just write a check, please.
Right.
In fact, that's not enough. You have to go and sweat yourself, because that's truly how you connect to people. And what Clarence Jordan believed was that's where redemption lies for everybody, for the haves as well as the have-nots.
Yeah, it's a great feeling when you go out there and do that. And like it says in the book, or you said in the book, it's not just a hand, but a hand up.
Well, that's right. In fact, that's a phrase you hear a lot among Habitat people and why they like it. It's not a hand out, it's a hand up. Because what people sometimes forget, I'll tell you a little story. One of my favorite people that I met through this book is a guy in Western Kentucky named Sherwood Kirk. And Sherwood and Marsha Kirk had never left the country until Sherwood retired. And when he retired, his brother, who was a professional builder and a Habitat volunteer, a man named Dale Kirk, said, "Sherwood, you got to come visit me. I'm going to be building these houses in Portugal. You got to come." And Sherwood went, I don't want to. He was really reluctant. Finally, Dale just made him come. And this was a guy who, until a week before he left, didn't have a passport.
Wow.
He just never had any interest in leaving the country.
No desire.
And so he goes he goes to visit his brother, who takes him from Portugal to Romania, where he'd built some houses the year before. And they're walking down the street on the first day, and all these people begin running up to his brother, shouting, "Mr. Dale, Mr. Dale!" And they run up to him and give him big hugs. And Sherwood starts scratching his head and saying, there must be something to this Habitat thing, because he'd never seen that kind of outpouring of emotion. And he and Marsha got hooked. They came back to Kentucky and signed up right away for the 2000 Carter Work Project, which was in Jacksonville that year, a week later.
Wow.
They've been to every work project since. When Sherwood was in Jacksonville, he made some new friends. He's a very gregarious guy. And they said, "Are you going next year?" And he said, "Really, where's it going to be next year?" And they said, "South Korea." And he said, "South Korea? Who goes to South Korea for a vacation?"
All these places he never wanted to go, but then he found out.
And he went to South Korea and loved it. He's been to every work project since. They go on trips all over the world to build Habitat homes. Habitat's become their life. And on one of their trips, they went to Northern Ireland. And Sherwood got into a conversation with a fellow. I don't know where it was, but I bet it was in a bar, because it sounds like that kind of conversation. And he starts talking to this guy, who says, "So you must like Habitat sending you all over the place." And Sherwood says, "Well, what do you mean sending?" And the guy says, "Well, you know, Habitat pays for your ticket, right?" And Sherwood says, "No, Habitat doesn't pay for my ticket." He says, "Oh, really? Well, they pay for your hotel, right, and your food." He goes, "No, they don't pay for anything, and we have to make a donation, too." And the guy says, wait, you're telling me you pay to come build people's houses?" And Sherwood says, "Absolutely." And so the guy says, "Well, I don't get it. Why would you do that?" And then Sherwood tells him this little story. And he says, "You know, when I'm building a house for somebody, they come up to me afterwards and say, thank you for letting, you know, for building my house with me."
Right.
And Sherwood says, and I say to them, "No, thank you for letting me." And he says, and he starts to get choked up. And this is, you know, Sherwood must be in his early 60s now,
mm-hmm.
or close to it. And he's a ex-high school administrator, not the kind of guy who'd start to cry. But he gets really choked up. And he says, "You know, it's such a personal thing for someone to let you build their house. And what they don't realize is that I'm getting so much more out of it than they are." And that's sort of like the underlying message of Habitat, and really the message of my book, because it's what I was taken so much by and what moved me. Another volunteer told me, "You know, for 10 years I've been working really hard to try to give more than I get, and I still haven't been able to do it."
You know, the vision that I got in my mind when I read part of that in your book was It's a Wonderful Life and the Bailey, building
Absolutely.
Alone. And when they're sitting there and they give the loaf of bread and the wine, you know, to the people going into their brand new house and shake their hand and gave them the affordable loan. And that was the image that I had in my mind when I was reading about and learning about Habitat for Humanity.
That's really interesting. But when you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life, the image that popped into my mind is the last scene mm-hmm. when George Bailey is redeemed and everyone's coming over to help him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always cry at that point.
Absolutely.
And I'm a cynic, and I always cry at that point. And that's the kind of feeling I got talking to these people about their experiences, that they're all George Bailey. These are, especially the partner families, these are people who've had very difficult lives, often through no fault of their own. They were born on the wrong side of the tracks or whatever. And for them, it's such an overwhelming emotional feeling. There's one story in the book that actually I got from someone who lives in Atlanta. Her name is Valerie Bean, and she is a regular mom who goes to soccer matches and school things
sure.
and birthday parties.
Glorified bus driver. I get it.
Yeah, she must own a minivan. And she told me the story about her experience on the 1999 Carter Work Project, which was in the Philippines. And she went over there and she worked on a house with a woman named Emma Bocalan. And Emma and her family had lived in an abandoned septic tank. which is kind of hard to imagine. Yeah. I think it was more like a shelter than, you know, it kept the rain off them, but it was a large concrete box. And Emma ended up with a house through that project. And it was an overwhelming experience for Emma and for Valerie, too, because at the end of the week, when the house was almost done, there was a young news reporter who came by to tape some interviews. And so she spoke with Emma, and she asked Emma how she felt being a Habitat homeowner. And Emma stood up straight and said, you know, I'm just a poor washerwoman. And people always told me I'd never have a house. My kids would never go to school. I'd never have any of those kind of things. But now I have a house. Look at my beautiful home. Look at my beautiful home. And Emma's home, as Valerie described it, had no room separations. It was a concrete house.
Right.
And she said that it was not as nice as the kind of things that Americans build to put their riding lawnmowers in.
Right.
In comparison. But for Emma Bocalan, it was a mansion. And when Valerie heard her talking in this way, the shy woman standing up proud, she started to cry. And what she told me about that experience was that it really renewed her faith in mankind. And it made her feel more than ever that people were good if they had an opportunity to show it. And that's really what Habitat does. It creates that bridge so that people who have something to give have a way of giving it that they wouldn't be able to do on their own. But as part of this organized structure, they can give, and the emotions can move back and forth between people, and it changes everybody involved. And even listening to the stories, it changes me. And my hope, of course, is that people reading these stories, it'll change their lives too.
Absolutely. Well, it definitely inspired me reading the book. And the other thing I learned about this that I walked away with is that is a basic human right. You know, they talk about human rights and how well President Carter did with that around the world. But one of the basic human rights is to be able to have a place to live, not just freedom of speech and religion and things like that.
I think that's absolutely right. What a lot of people forget is that human rights was not part of the vocabulary of this country before President Carter's presidency. I'm old enough to remember it pretty well. And it just wasn't a phrase that anyone heard. And President Carter made it part of our political vocabulary, and it's stuck. And that's been of great benefit to people all over the world.
David, what are some of your overall hopes for the book?
Well, Mike, I actually have a really clear hope. And what it is that in 5 or 10 or 15 years, young people will start showing up on Habitat sites, and people will say, hey, why did you find out about us? Why are you here? And I'll say, you know, when I was in 7th grade, I read this book, and it really opened my eyes and changed my life. And I'm here because of what I read then.
That's a great hope to have, and a great testament for what you've done.
Thank you, Mike.
David Rubel, author of If I Had a Hammer, which is now available.
It's available wherever books are sold, Mike.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
This has been Community Perspective, a public affairs program presented by Salem Media of Georgia and our stations WFSH, WGKA, WNIV, and WLTA. We welcome other perspectives and viewpoints. You may contact us at Community Perspective, 2970 Peachtree Road Northwest, Suite 700, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. Join us next week for more Community Perspectives.